General Semantics, December 14, 1962. Today, I want to continue what I was discussing last time and go on to talk about listening. I'm hunting for something I can't find. I want to begin by calling attention to this kind of a scheme for organizing our thinking about the way that we interact with people in situations where we are attempting to work together with others. And this includes every sort of a situation, from family to large organization of any kind, of an educational sort, industrial, sports, anything of the sort. I assume that the ideal kind of an orientation is what Blake calls a 9-9 orientation, a high degree of concern for people and a high degree of concern for achievement. But an integration of these concerns so that the individuals who are involved get maximal satisfaction from achieving, from the work or the activity involved, so that they don't need, or at least using the word need here to refer to something undesirable, they don't lack for some satisfactions which can be gained only through diversions, or so that they are not being manipulated by what amount to diversions or to distractions or to compensations for what is otherwise drudgery or activities of any kind so done that they are experienced as drudgery. Well, now, in this kind of a situation in which you have a 9-9 orientation, you have a certain distinctive kind of an interaction communicatively, I think, among the persons involved. I want to talk mainly about the listening aspects of this, but there is something to be said also about the sending or the speaking aspects of it. I can indicate part of what I think is very important about the speaking behavior of people under these conditions by telling you briefly about an observation I made the other day when I was sitting in on a program, part of a program. I had been talking to a group for the Army. This was a training program for personnel counselors or administrators. And after my talk, they broke up into groups. There were about a dozen in a group. And in the group I was in, permitted to be in, this was supposed to be closed, they had paired off earlier in the week, and on this day they were supposed, if they wanted to offer evaluations of each other. Supposedly they had been observing each other in a variety of situations, and now they were supposed to be trying to help each other to understand themselves better. And one of the members of the group, in the course of the meeting, offered her evaluation of one of the other members. And what she said, I think, is one of these things I'm going to remember all my life. She said to him, "You have a way of speaking to me or to anyone else about anything so that when you're done, there's something left for me to say." I thought that was one of the finest compliments I'd ever heard anybody paid. You speak so that when you're done, there's something left for me to say. So many people speak as though when they're done, that's it. There's nothing more to be said. And you can only agree, or else you can decide to make an issue of it. I think we were all a little bit amused that morning. We had a visitor. He was the, whatever the title is, of the military officer who is the top dog for the whole Midwest. And I don't know his title, and I don't know just what it is that he has charge of, but I gathered he was the top official for the area, and the area was rather big. Included Chicago and evidently much of the Midwest. He had just come. He'd been signed there from the chiefs of staff. He'd been with McNamara. Well, he was quite a guy in terms of who he was. He was introduced before I talked because he was there. He was introduced. Now, this was a meeting. This was a program which was lasting for 2 weeks, in which the participants were being encouraged to be curious about administration, about supervision, about personnel counseling, to wonder about it, to consider all the various ways you might think about it and do it. And there was a good deal of emphasis upon the 9-9 kind of orientation. The commandant, when he was introduced, felt called upon to speak, and he did for 5 minutes. And in 5 minutes, he told them how to be good administrators. It was rather pathetic. And I thought that the group was, I thought they showed to good effect the training they'd had in the last 10 days. The way they responded, they were very, very understanding. This is apparently the only way this man could speak, having been trained as he had in the 1-9 kind of orientation, essentially. You give orders and they are to be obeyed, but you must, well, not 1-9, but in 3-9. You must be decent to people. And then they'll respond and do what must be done. Well, this is a serious problem. This is, I think, the way most people have been influenced to think about what is the right way to behave when you're responsible for the activities of other people, as a father or mother, or as a teacher, supervisor, or commandant, whatnot. When he got done, there was nothing to say, you see, except, I suppose, yes, sir. Or you could make an issue of it, or you could ignore it, as I did, and make your speech, which I did. I watched him as he was listening to 9-9 for an hour and a half. And at the break, he came over. He brought his coffee over and we talked. And it was a very interesting conversation. As he'd been made obviously thoughtful. And he was saying, this is a very difficult kind of job, isn't it? Trying to be in charge of something. And if he had made the speech to the group that consisted of the conversation he had with me, it would have been a good speech. He was very thoughtful, very, very wondering. Well, now, how do you bring about the kind of behavior which Blake is trying to represent in this rather effective way? There is something to be said about the way you speak to people when you work with them. There's a book on the list that you have by Irving Lee called How to Talk with People. I think it is just a very good book. I think that anyone who wants to learn how to talk with children or how to talk with students or how to talk with employees or employers or with friends or associates ought to read this book. Irving Lee was a semanticist, and so he didn't write a technical book. He wanted to communicate. He valued communication. And so he wrote a book for anybody to read, and it's a very readable kind of book. He sat through 200 board meetings, committee meetings, of various organizations, and made observations of the problems that the members of these boards and committees had in talking with each other. And the book consists of descriptions of the problems they had that he observed. And then he observed, I think it was 16 groups or 13 out of the 200 who didn't have any problems, and he described those. And that's one of the best chapters in the book. That is the behavior he described in that chapter could be the norm. Very easily. It wouldn't take much education. I think, maybe I'm too hopeful, but I think that's right. It could be the norm. Not only in boards and committees, but in families and in classrooms and in shops and offices and wherever. Well, some of the things you'd observe, I think, if you were to observe such groups getting along well, is the tone with which the people speak to each other, with each other. It's a kindly tone. It's a tone that can be, I hesitate to say cultivated, because it implies that there is some, that I'm suggesting that you don't ever really feel that way, but you can act as though you did. And that isn't what I mean. I mean you can really feel that way. It's the tone that you tend to develop, I think. If, for example, you were to tape record your discussions with other people and listen to the tapes, you would simply, I think, eliminate the harshness, the self-provincialism, the tone which says there isn't any other point of view but this. The tone that says, well, if you don't agree with me, you just must be a dope. It's a tone. People who have been housebroken enough not to really get angry, nevertheless, manage somehow to convey by a tone that their relationship with you is not very good. And it's hard to describe this tone. I don't suppose we should even try. You can learn to notice it. You can learn to recognize it when you hear it. I would venture a few adjectives. I think it tends to be a tone that the lady described. But you're talking about the man. A tone that leaves you the possibility of responding to it. A tone that invites response. A tone that leaves the question open. It is a kind of a questioning tone. I think if one were to make an acoustic analysis of such speech, it would actually be different. The pattern of inflection would be different. For one thing, I think it would not be what we call crisp, or staccato, or brisk, but rather there would be a good deal of prolonged sounds in it. And the transitions from word to word and from sentence to sentence, from phrase to phrase, would be sort of smooth. There would be something about the wording, the phrasing, that I think would be distinctive, and I suppose most of what would be observable could be summed up in the term tuminous. There'd be a good deal of tuminous, a good deal of appears and seems, and I think, I went back, I talked twice with this Army group, once on a Thursday and then the following Tuesday. I came back and a person in charge said, "You never heard so many I thinks in your life since you were here." And there's something else that it's very difficult to, I don't know how to say it. I'm sure you would observe it. Let's just call it a kind of an interactive orientation. The speakers act as though they wanted to interact, not just in the tone, not just in the wording, but in everything they do, and in the timing, and in the posture, and in all the rest of it. There is an interactive behavior, rather than a directive behavior, a manipulative behavior, or an acquiescent behavior. There's an interactive behavior. You're not just being a nice guy so that the boss will behave himself. It isn't that kind of behavior. It's interactive. It's behavior reflecting mutual respect. The main thing that I think you would notice would be the listening behavior, and that's what I want to talk about the rest of the hour. I think listening is the most important part of anyone's communicated behavior from the point of view of the possibility of improvement, of doing something about your communicated behavior. You can do something about listening. You can do it rather easily. You can practice it most of the day. And what you do will make a big difference. And this means that the new behavior will tend to be reinforced, and so you'll learn it fairly fast. There are some things we need to know about listening that, in order to know a little bit about what there is to avoid or what there is to stop doing that we tend to do, there are many things. I'm going to limit this to just a few things. We tend to over-attend to the irrelevant. And the irrelevant includes who the speaker is, what his title is, how old he is, whether his hair is gray or doesn't have any, or is brown or blue. I'm not advocating that you not respect an older speaker with an imposing title. I'm not advocating that you not respect anybody. I think you should respect him no matter what his title is, no matter what his age is. That isn't the point. Just don't be hypnotized. Don't pay so much attention to the title or the lack of it, to the symbols of authority or lack of them, that you don't listen well. I think we tend to do this. We tend to listen defensively. I want to say one more thing about this thing of the attending to the irrelevant. I think that it is poor listening, in the sense, if you measure it by its effects on the listener, to be distracted, to be concerned to the point of distraction with the speaker's appearance, the way he dresses, combs his hair, whether he has a beard or not, what color he is, whether he speaks with some kind of mannerism, jiggles his keys, or maybe says every 6 words. These things don't matter to a good listener. Listeners who pay a lot of attention to them, I think, pay a very heavy price for paying a lot of attention to these things. Whether the speaker makes grammatical errors, as they are called, by somebody who thinks he knows an error when he sees one, whether he, according to the listener, mispronounces a word, these things don't matter to a good listener. Now this, I know, is flying in the face of a great deal that you've been taught. It's very important to use good speech and to stand up straight and don't jiggle your keys and what else should you not to do? Don't move or something. Every public speaking teacher can tell you just how to make speech. This isn't important. Lie down on the floor if you want to. What is important is that you say something and it be dependable. And if possible, a little interesting. Life's kind of short. Just don't be bored if we can help it. And a good listener is listening for what the speaker says, and if it is important or worth listening to, he doesn't care how he says it or what kind of uniform he has on or doesn't have on. So, now, I must watch myself here. I'll talk all afternoon about this one thing. I think it's something, if you did very much lecturing, you would get terribly impressed by what people tell you when they come up after the lecture, such as, you know, it's almost depressing how people, not just after a lecture, but 5 years afterward, will remember one thing you said. And you wonder, what were they doing during all the rest of the time? One thing, at one point you made, that's it may be. I suppose there's some kind of a limit to what most people can attend to or retain. And if they can't abstract very well, they don't get the main point. They get a point that they can retain. Well, that's not good listening. Abstract. Get what be understanding. I'm very worried about what objective examinations do to us. Not just objective examination, but this, it seems to me, is an instrument designed by the devil for this purpose. Of getting us to pay attention to details as details rather than to abstract. Get the point. Understand this whole thing that you're hearing. We listen defensively. I talked, didn't I, about verbal nesting? Remember verbal nesting? People make for themselves, each person makes for himself a verbal nest that is comfortable. He likes it there. He talks about himself, other people, his children, his problems, so that what he says about them are tolerable to him. Verbal nesting. Well, this people live in their verbal nests all the time. They take them with them wherever they go. They take them to lectures, for example. And they fight the lecturer off if he tries to get them out of their verbal nest. They take them to clinics and they fight the counselor off if he tries to get them out of their verbal nest. They like it in there. Be it ever so stinky, there's no verbal nest like their own. And so they listen defensively. We listen defensively. And we like to hear certain things said because we would have said them had we thought of them. And we tend to listen defensively so that we tend to some degree, which varies with each of us, to react to the verbal input as though to a potential threat. If we accept it, if we assimilate it, evaluate it, and integrate it into our own thinking, we may have to change. And this is a risk. And so we listen sort of warily. And that's not very good listening. when it's done, just to protect conclusions we've already come to and feelings we've already developed and so on. We've talked about the fact that in the process of communication, after the speaker has jiggled the air, has created the airwaves, as soon as they leave his mouth, he's through. The listener takes it from there. We've talked about this, I assume, or you've read about it. The listener brings the words with him. He supplies the words. Nothing passes from me to you but air vibrations. You bring the words. All your notebooks will be different at the end of the year. We translate. Now, you can't help this, but after all, the airwaves are coded, patterned. You can match them. You can match the resulting, after a series of energy transformations, there is a resulting impulse, nervous impulse, which arrives in your brain with a certain frequency and amplitude characteristic, which you can probably match. Now, you will tend not to. You will tend to translate it rather than to accept it and use it. Translate it into the words you are used to using. The words you would use if you were to say what you think the speaker is saying. And so you say, now what he really meant was. And so then you say what you would have meant. Well, this is poor listening. What is good listening is to try not to translate. Try to use the words of this speaker and see how they feel. Try them on for size, as it were. You learn more that way. You can translate to the point where you leave with exactly what you came in with. Now, if you want to be a good listener, a better one than you are, the best way I know is to try to find one. This will be rather difficult. They're pretty rare. And if you find one, he'll probably be a counselor, clinical counselor, social worker maybe, or maybe a judge or a lawyer occasionally. And sometimes he just will be almost anything, a person who has learned to listen. But this is a very rare kind of person. But if you can find one, then the way I think to learn to be a good listener is to do what he does, and you'd be awkward, but keep on. And as you do more of it, you will get better. Now, what you will see him doing are things like this, I think. First of all, he listens much more, or he seems to. Partly, it is a matter of posture and attitude and intention. You may have 5 minutes to spend with a friend, but you can act for 5 minutes as though you had all day. And this is the kind of thing a good listener does. He isn't sitting on the edge of his chair looking at his watch. He is acting as though he intended to listen the rest of his life for 2 minutes. You know, the best of the clinical counselors who seem to be listening and doing nothing else, I've gone through quite a few counseling hours. I'll bet the tapes would show I hadn't uttered more than 10 words. But this counselor always manages to to terminate the session. He doesn't listen all day. It just seems like it. It was right up to the time that you stop listening. There's almost no clue that it's going to stop. In other words, he gives his very full attention. And this is easy to say. We've all been urged to do this many times, I suppose, by someone. But it takes a lot of practice. Good listener listens with a kind of purpose. Most listeners, I think if you get tuned into this and notice listening behavior, and it is fascinating to observe, you won't believe your ears and eyes once you really start watching it. You just can't believe that people could carry on organized society that way. It is amazing how often three or four people are talking at once. Nobody's listening. Nobody's listening. Not even to himself. It's amazing how often someone interrupts someone else. You would keep track of this. Just make tally mark every time this happens in a representative sampling of situations. I think you would be greatly impressed. You would also observe that it is very often true of, let's just call him the average listener, that when he does interrupt, when he does speak, it is to refute. He has been listening to find an advantage he can take. He has been listening to win. He wants to come out of the encounter feeling as though he got the better of it, apparently. A good listener just never does this. He just listens to understand. He's just listening to understand. He isn't trying to win. He doesn't want to refute anything. He just wants to hear more. This is an awfully good thing to practice with people with whom you don't agree. It is terribly interesting. The next time you begin to get into what would ordinarily be an argument, you will keep it from being an argument very easily, just by listening. You may not have to say a word. You'll just listen. The other guy will probably talk all day. But listen. Listen as though you were trying to understand. As though you really were a counselor and your only purpose in life was to be understanding. And see what you hear.
Not at all foregone conclusion that you will end up agreeing, but I think it is a foregone conclusion that you will end up being much better informed about what it is you don't agree with. And the odds are that you will end up with an improved understanding of what is being talked about. You have a lot to learn from people you don't agree with. If people agree with you too much, you have nothing to learn from them. There is no point in talking with them except to enjoy their company. That's what we have the word fatter communion for, you know, just making pleasant noises together. Good listener listens because of these other things he does. He listens sort of permissively, I guess is the word. Anything goes. You can tell a good listener anything. The way you can tell whether you're improving as a listener is that people are telling you things they haven't been telling you before. If they're not, you're no better than you were. Because they have more to tell you than they've been telling you. They're talking to you more about more things, more significantly. Because a good listener is very receptive. I've had many persons tell me I was the first good listener they'd ever had. And I felt that after I'd had the first good listener I'd ever had. You see, parents can't very well fill this role for most children, or for any maybe, I don't know, because they're too much concerned with bringing the child up according to some kind of standards they have. And they can't be wholly permissive. They can't listen with the attitude that anything goes. The child can tell his mother anything, just anything. It would take a very, very remarkable mother, or one that was hard of hearing, not to say, you shouldn't talk like that. You shouldn't ever say things like that. Or you're wrong. Here, now, this is what you ought to think. You know. Well, you can't. It's hard to talk to a listener like that. Beyond a certain point. Most teachers aren't good listeners because they're too intent on teaching. And it takes a very remarkable teacher to listen to a student say something that, according to the teacher, is not correct. But just listen. Of course, this is what the best teachers do a lot of. There are a lot of very good elementary school teachers, I think, who are good largely because they pay such close attention to what the children tell them. And so they really get to know the children. But they're the best ones. The good listener listens then without any moral judgments. He doesn't ever say tisk tisk. Whatever the person has to say, that's what the person has to say. You try to understand it. And he develops an ear, or a third ear. He's very attentive to what the person doesn't say, that he might have said, since he said what he did say. Very sensitive to the veerings away from the main point. But he's very patient. He knows the speaker will get to it next week. He may have to make several passes at it. And each time he'll veer away. But finally he'll be able to manage it. But you can't pull it out of him. And you wouldn't want to anyway. Not a good listener. A good listener would never say, "Now, come on, tell me the truth. Come clean. Come on, I'll level with me." I don't think a good listener would ever do that. He'd wait. And the leveling would come. He's not leveling with you see. He's leveling with himself. And he can't do it today. And a listener who says, "Oh, come on now, come off it," is naive. He doesn't understand. There's only so much that a speaker can say today. And he'll say it if you'll listen. Well, all these are things that a good listener does to make the conditions so that the person can talk. My little alarm is about to go off, and I want to tell you real fast that there are some things that a good listener does quite positively. This is, after all, he's being helpful. He's an eavesdropper who is has a purpose of helping the person talking to him to understand better himself what it is he's talking about. He's trying to solve a problem. And so he asks a lot of questions, which all come down to four, and you've heard him before, so all I need to do is to remind you of them. What do you mean? Tell me more about it. Don't tell me, tell yourself, you see. Do a better job of gathering the information that you have to deal with. What do you mean? The what, the when, the where, the who kind of question. What then, and what then, and what then? What all happened? But a person has been drawing conclusions, and so he says, there are a lot of questions about how do you know, how else might this be explained, how sure are you, so forth. What is your evidence, how good is it, how adequate is it, what else do you need to know before you draw such a conclusion? But he draws some conclusion. So there are a lot of questions about the importance of this. So maybe Bill doesn't love you. How important is this? What difference does it make? And so on. What will happen now? Well, maybe the decision is it is important. All right. What had best be done about it? What is there to do? A good listener always is pointing toward a course of action, toward doing something, not just talking for talking's sake or listening for listening's sake. The verbal levels of abstracting should be related to the nonverbal. Talk should be translated into action. And a good listener tries to bring this about in the most effective possible way. So now this is the day to wish you Merry Christmas and much achievement.